From the Quackalope Network headquarters, this is the Weekly Quack with Board Game Co., your ultimate source for what's happening around the board game pond. In this week's installment, we talk about a game of Koi and Points, play Tack, and discuss the most important subject of all, you.
Hello, hello, and welcome to the Weekly Quack, your weekly tune-in for all the duck-related and goose-related stuff happening around the board game pond. I'm one of your co-hosts, or hosts, or something, stuff and things and such, Jesse Samuel Anderson, and with me is the egregious Jan Begus, my co-host and soon-to-be roommate.
Is this supposed to be an intro? Because this is horrible so far.
Along with him is also going to be the muskrat himself, Alexander Board Game Sender Radcliffe, the second from North Hampshire. I don't remember what your name is.
Jesse, what are you doing? This is a sacred ritual of our podcast. Yep. Alex's name, or mm-hmm. Randolph's name, must always be read.
I hear you.
What are you doing? Why are we going against the format of our show today?
All I'm gonna be honest, heard Jan, is my name must always be
it's
read.
It's been a month.
We can add that. Alexander, Sender, Radcliffe, Randolph, the third, the red, or something. We could throw it in there somehow. Then my name always will be read. We'll figure it out.
Let's do it. Where is it going to go?
All that being said, for those of you that are tuning in to the Weekly Quack for the very first time, we appreciate you being here. These mellow and dramatic tones are not going to be the standard approach we take, but I promise you, they'll come back at some point during this show. If you'd like to engage in a conversation with us, please direct yourself over to theweeklyquack.com, where you can leave a comment or a question. In fact, this episode will be slightly different due to the fact that we had an influx of comments from the last podcast we did. Here you'll hear us do three core things. Squabble with each other. One, it's a standard thing that this show exists around. Second, talk about some games that are either being added or leaving our collection on the shelf or sell segment. And then this time, instead of the medley minute or the on the radar, we're going to dive deep. That's right, into the customer feedback. Reading your questions and doing our very best to respond in the most appropriate way possible. I'll be your tour guide for this adventure. And with that, join me.
Jesse, before...
I actually really did enjoy those dulcet tones. I want
actually,
to
my request is, can you never do that again?
You know, Jan, life has a funny way of requiring things that are never ought to be done once more. I'm committed to these dulcet tones. To talk this way.
Oh, God, I hate it. I hate it so much.
Like a gentle earworm squabbling its way into your mustache.
Okay. You know what? I'm starting shelf for self because I cannot hear you a single second more. I am bringing in Kohaku.
You know, Jan.
Does anybody know about this game?
You know what goes nice with koi ponds?
No, Jan. Alex, do you know? You're right, Jesse.
Gentle.
Alex, do you know about this game?
Dulcet.
So Kohaku's going to be that tile lane game with the fish, right?
Yes, by Gold Seal Games. It has the deluxe edition with the acrylic tiles.
And that deluxe edition, you're saying that's like an over the top, overproduced game that is unnecessary for what you actually get out of the experience.
Kohaku is a peaceful koi pond building tile laying game. Each turn, players will draft both a koi and a feature tile from the central pond board to place into their personal koi pond. You score points by surrounding flowers with koi, containing matching colors, placing frogs next to koi tiles that have dragonflies, and ensuring that baby koi have a safe place to hide by placing them near rocks. After there are no more koi tiles available to refill the central board, the game ends and players will total the points scored by each feature in their pond. The player with the most points is going to win.
Now, Jan, this was a game that you had some history with. We covered this. We covered the Kickstarter of this way back in the day when we had little cardboard cutouts showing off the artwork, exclaiming about how the production quality was going to be beautiful.
Wait, one second. You're saying there's cardboard cutouts of you and Jan somewhere? I want
those. Yes, 100%. You didn't know that?
Absolutely, I want those.
They were a staple of the channel in the very first
yeah,
weeks.
Yeah, if we're going to be honest, if you look at the first probably 3 or 4 months of content on the Quackalope channel, all of that is just cardboard images.
It's all excellent editing. Like, yeah. You never really see our mouths move, but looks like our mouths are moving.
People always wonder why each video takes me anywhere from 8 to 10 hours to fully produce. The honest answer, it's all stop motion done in real time. And with that being said, we have a history with this game, and I, sadly, have not been able to play the production copy of it yet. So I don't know if it's been tweaked, if it's been changed, if the final version of it is something that you would love. I do know, however, both of us were excited about, advocated for, and felt that the relaxing and, dare I say, dulcet nature of that original...
I hate that you transitioned back into it.
Of that
I really
original
do.
Prototype... was something that we were excited to get a full production copy of. We were very excited about that prototype originally. I said that 3 or 4 times. Original
yes,
prototypes and the prototype that was originally prototyped was something that all of us were excited about.
Alex, please.
Yeah, and Kohaku is one that I can't remember when we've talked about this one before, but it has come up before. It's a game that was never on my radar in the original Kickstarter, and it is one that, well, I mean... it's tiling on the one hand, which generally is pretty decent. It's being rated pretty decently as well from everything I can see about the game. But something about it doesn't pull me in. I don't know if it's the fish theme. I don't know if it's the actual iconography or what's going on. I'm just not pulled in by it while respecting the fact that people seem to like it.
So, Jan, how many times have you played this? And superficially, what do you think of the production quality?
I think I've played this about 3 times at this point. The production,
that's more than he's played any game this year.
Well, one was with you a year ago or more than a year ago. I'm not even sure at this point.
Doesn't count.
And in terms of the production quality, I think it's okay.
That's high praise. High praise indeed. Okay.
I'll expand on that later, but I do need to hear what you guys think first.
I mean, I think that's all I really need to know. You're getting rid of this. It's not even a question. You are far from effervescent. Is that that's not the right word at all, but I'm going to stick with it. You are far from effervescent about the game.
I don't agree. And maybe it's a hopeful side of me, but I remember really, really being charmed by how calming this game was. It had a different pace, different tone, different texture to the experience. And so I hope you still enjoy this game. I know I have a copy. I'm looking forward to playing it. So I think you're holding on to it for now. And along with that, you also do just enjoy abstract puzzles. And this one, as far as I remember, was a pretty darn decent one.
I just have to say that I'm so grateful that you didn't go back to your dulcet tones. And you know what? To continue that line of thought, Jesse. So Kohaku is a game that is definitely staying in my collection. I have always enjoyed this game in terms of the mechanical straightforwardness of it all. In terms of the production, unfortunately, the effect with the acrylic tiles is not as evident as I wanted it to be. I think there should have probably been a third layer in terms of that effect that they were going for to create that depth of field. But with that being said, the weightiness of the tiles, the general translucent effect of those tiles really does a lot to evoke that meditative state in this game. That is one of the things that I most appreciate about it. I feel a certain calmness and serenity whenever I do delve into this pond. And it is one that, for now, is definitely going to be staying in my collection for a good, long time.
See, this is why I didn't try the dulcet tones, because Jesse did them so well that I was worried about just failing abysmally. And then, of course, you would leave it in the podcast. So it would be entertaining.
What? Good You're morning, saying that and, my dulcet tones were not beautiful and amazing and
no,
seductive?
I did not say that, Jen. I merely inferred it.
Oh.
It's currently 6:23 a.m., and I want to welcome you to a brand new PBS Hour. Today, we're going to be talking about the way that the infrastructure of the
Anderson, could you...
Well,
could
let's be honest. I can pull off PBS as long as we're going with, like, Elmo or something like that.
What was I?
Elmo's World.
What was I?
La, 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 la. La 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 la,
Elmo's World. La, 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 la. Okay, seriously, right, guys.
We're losing
our subscribers.
Pulling it back to something stable. We already lost them. Let's be honest. The dulcet tones have invited more and lost some along the way. It always happens on the
Jesse,
road we travel, Jan.
Stop.
That being said, I'm glad you like this game.
Oh, wait. Did you know ducks always return to their flocks? That's a duck fact. Oh, my gosh. Aren't you excited? Children, do you want to know more?
Oh, God, that is going to haunt my dreams.
All that being said, I'm glad you like this game, because for me, while I agree the production quality is maybe not to where I hoped it would be, I know they had some issues in terms of manufacturing. They had a few people that wrote back to them saying, we literally can't do what you're asking for. And they're like, no, we have a prototype. You can. And China still said, no, I don't think we're able to. The complications when it comes to production quality and getting something exactly how you had dreamed it would be is always more of an issue. But the gameplay, from what I'm hearing, holds up. This is still the experience that we had when we had those little cardboard tiles. The production quality is better than the prototype that we had. And so from my stance, I'm excited to get this one back out to the table. I found this one to be a relaxing and meditative abstract puzzle that was worth digging into every single time I returned to it.
And let me be clear. The acrylic tiles do give that effect of water. It totally happens. It's just that I wanted a little bit more play with perspective in them. But it does work, and it does add to the experience.
So I'm not really sure what you mean about 3D perspective, but ultimately that's not really what I guess I care about for the game to begin with. I going back to my earlier point, my lack of interest in it, what is it about this game that pulls you in, and what would you compare it to most?
Great question. This is one of the more simple tile laying games that I have, and it really comes down to the way that the restrictions on the tile laying affect the scoring at the very end of this. Basically, every time that you grab a tile, you grab a set of tiles, and you're grabbing from a drafting area that is in constant motion to a certain degree. Basically, the tiles that you draft have a repercussion as to the location of the rest of the draft zone, which I think is really interesting. It's almost like a flowing river to a certain degree. It feels alive. Once you draft those pieces, you can break them apart in any shape, way, or form, but they always have to be placed down in a checker pattern. One of the interesting things about this particular tile laying game that a lot of tile laying games do, but is that you don't have a restriction as to how you can grow your pond. You can grow your pond horizontally as much as you want. You can grow it vertically. You can make a weird amalgamation of semicircles or whatever placement that you want to do your tiles in if you follow that checkerboard pattern, which gives it a really good feeling of progression and personality to what you're trying to do. Ultimately, it does come down to the color coding in this, and it comes down to the scoring. Scoring is done through a multiplicity of ways, so there's a lot of options on the board, and you never really feel like you're drafting something that will be totally inconsequential on your turn, because you have. I believe that the draft area has about, I would say, over 16 options in total tiles.
And the way you then take and place and build out upon your own little koi pond, everything can fit in its own unique way.
Like, and that's a really good point, because it almost feels like you're creating small ecosystems or niches within that pond. You can have an area where you're focusing on one particular scoring pattern, which is to have similar colored fish. On the other side of your pond, you can concentrate on surrounding decorations so that you can maximize the point average of those. On another side, you can just bank straight victory points with frogs, et cetera, et cetera. So it gives you that space to...
I always love banking straight victory points with frogs.
Strictly speaking, didn't you just bank victory points with frogs on last week's episode?
Oh, good tie in there. Well done, Cosmic Quack.
Dun-dun-dun-dun.
But yeah, so at the end, Alex, this is a very flexible tile layer. I don't think it does anything particularly innovative, but I feel it's the sum of its parts that makes it into a special tile layer in my own collection. And it's one that I like. I like how accessible it is. You can teach this in a matter of 2 to 3 minutes and you're ready to go. And speaking back to those games that we can just leave on a table set up at any time, this comes with a neoprene mat. with stitched corners. It also has these, as we described, incredible, beautiful tiles for what they were able to do. This is a centerpiece game. And this is one that if I had a nice little coffee table, it's probably one I'd just leave out there because it is that pretty.
It's that pretty? It's so interesting to me because when I look at pictures online, like, it looks fine. I can't tell if it's one of those in-person things or just the art style doesn't pull me in personally.
It could be the art style. I personally really enjoy the art style. Even from the prototype that we had back in the day, I thought that the way that they captured the fish moving and the ripples in the water was really, really quaint.
Yeah, Jan cool. and I both really did enjoy that initial art style. All that being said, Jan, I'm excited you're keeping yours, which means I'll probably also be keeping mine until, of course, we move in together, and then I can sell yours and you can share mine. All that being
said, other way around.
What? I am really glad that we all committed to bringing in abstract games this week. And Alex, I'm bringing in a game that you actually suggested I should play. I brought in Shobu a little while ago as something that I wanted to reinvent and redesign, a showpiece game, a game that I thought stood the test of time that had been invented recently. And you mentioned a little game by the name of Tack.
Oh, did you play Tack?
I did.
Ooh, when did you play Tack?
Alex, this was a game that you described as your ancient game that was invented newly, right? The game that felt like it had existed forever and that you'd honestly consider putting hundreds of dollars into a fully produced, beautiful hardwood edition of 100%. At some point, which if you don't have by next Christmas, seems like a perfect gift for you and your family. Not that I would get it for you, but I might like gift giving slightly. It's how I tell you that I love you. All that being said, Tack is going to be a game. It's going to be an abstract strategy game played between two players. It's dreamed up by Path Ruthfuss in the Wise Man's Fear and is made reality by James Ernest. In Tack, players will attempt to make a road of their pieces connecting two opposite sides of the board. Now, that sounds very simple, right? Take a few abstract pieces and create a pathway or a road from one edge to the other. The complicated part is actually how you play the game. You see, these pieces can do a lot more than just exist on this grid. They can shift, they can stack on top of each other, they can move each other if you're moving a whole line of them at the same time, they can flip up onto their sides, creating barriers and obstacles and walls, and they can even introduce little figures or other pieces that can stomp on, crush, and flatten out pieces that have created barriers. The interplay between the two players is one of a constant shifting snake-like pattern, always trying to get the advantage and always trying to be one or two moves ahead of the other person you're playing against. If you are able to successfully outwit, sequence, or create even a zigzag pattern so that you connect two edges of the board, you will win this game. And, Alex, I know it's one you love, but do you think it's one that I loved?
That's an excellent question. I do wonder if it's one that you loved, because I happen to know exactly, or I guess I presume, because you see, I was around when he was playing Tack.
You were around.
I taught him the game.
You did teach me the game.
I taught him.
I'll
be
honest.
I taught him, and then I passed him off to another person because I just wanted to see him destroy Shira. Yeah, Shira. She's actually going to be showing up in your channel soon. She's showed up in a few videos, played a few games, and she'll probably show up in my channel as well here and there.
Oh, badass.
And yeah, and Tack is one that I taught the game, handed it off, and then proceeded to wander around while just paying attention to the occasional punctuated noises of someone winning who was clearly, so clearly not you.
Okay. All right. I see what you did there. Yeah, we probably played, because I know Jan's going to ask, we probably played about 5 games total, and I actually want to talk about the way that you taught us this after, of course, we get through the judgment call from you and Jan.
You don't need to wait up for me. I will be very surprised if you have not already ordered a custom wooden version of this game. It sounds to me like you made a really strong connection through this game, like you made a new friendship. And if I know you well, Anderson, is that you keep things that remind you of others. So I have a feeling that Tack is now in your permanent collection.
I have removed every visage of a goose that exists in my house.
Wow, bro. That's very hurtful because there's going to be a goose living permanently in the house. So,
oh dear. Mm.
So yeah, Jesse, you're totally keeping this one, 100%.
Am I? Well, not keeping your copy of this. Am I seeking out my own? I suppose would be the question.
I imagine you are. I could always, of course, be wrong, but you did seem to be having fun. You did seem to enjoy the process of losing, the process of getting in there. And I think you even won one game. Is that correct? Did you win one?
I won both introduction games.
Introduction games.
When the kid gloves were on.
Gotcha. So once you proceeded to the full game, that's when you started losing.
Won every game after that.
So what you're saying is that I have to take pointers from Shira to actually beat you at games? Is that what?
We all should take more pointers from Shira.
Yeah, that sounds like overall great advice. So Jesse, what are you doing with that?
No, I haven't voted yet, but I agree. I'm voting that he's keeping it. I could be wrong, but I assume he is.
Worthwhile jump in there, Alex.
Yes, thank you. Yes, I wanted to add value to the conversation.
Welcome. You're welcome. I was absolutely charmed by this game. You're 100% right. I mean, it really is a game that feels like it has just existed, but honestly, feels better than the games that already existed, like chess and checkers and Othello.
I'll have to play this.
And the other abstracts, Tak or Tak, I don't know how you actually say it. This is such a refined little puzzle. And despite the fact that I lost horrendously to this young lady that was sitting across from me, did not remove the fact that it was such a intriguing little obstacle course to figure out. And the mechanics of it. Alex, you taught this game in a very specific and particular way. You started with the basic concept, a small, I believe, 4x4 grid with a few blank pieces, none of which had any special abilities, all of which were trying to do one simple task, get to the other side of the board. From there, you increase to a 5x5, introducing the concept of creating barriers and explaining in a little bit more depth how you could stack them on top of each other to create lines or sequences of movement. And then finally, we got up to a full board on the back, I believe still maybe a 5x5, but you started introducing special and upgraded little mechanics and puzzles, like the figurine that could move across the board and stomp on walls and obstacles that had been erected. That was the point where I started losing every game that I played. But I really appreciated the way that you approach teaching Tak. I thought it was reasoned, and I thought it was probably one of the most approachable ways I've ever been taught an abstract game.
I don't disagree. I really enjoy the system of gameplay that manages to teach you as you play, but while not sacrificing on what it means to be taught while you play. There are so many games that you jump in and people are like, oh, I just want to start moving, but you can't practically do so without compromising the experience. Versus you find a game like Tak or the Oniverse series for that matter, that gives you that actual process of engaging people along the way, one step, two step, three step, each its own little puzzle, and it makes each additional step in that sequence almost more intriguing because you start with a core concept and you're like, that's interesting, but I'm also not going to get that. And then you get a little bit more and it's like, well, that was cool. I like now the puzzle that's being presented. And then you get to that third tier and you're like, this game just keeps on giving. And that's when you really dive down into the strategy of it. And Tak is my favorite abstract, hands down, for a reason. It is one that I imagine will be in my collection for years, decades to come. It is the game that I want to teach people quickly off the bat, pull it out, be like, hey, I know you like games, but here, let's just get this to the table and let's have a little bit of fun together. And yeah, because it plays on those different levels, it means you can get a few games in 2 minutes. You can get a few games in hours at a time, playing again and again, back to back.
It was absolutely beautiful and genuinely one that when talking about abstract games, I'm glad I have in my arsenal of discussion now. Jan, this is a game that I think you'd really, really love and one that we're going to have to play together very soon.
So let's see. On Etsy, there's, again, we went through this conversation last time, but I think it's time to actually pull the trigger now. So I'm going to be making some.
48 hours.
It's been over 3 weeks at this point. This is just the confirmation.
No, this is new information that you have. You always have to gauge new information with a 48-hour window because it's the only way we keep you from going into abstract poverty and debt.
Okay. I will say this. of all the, first of all, I don't really understand how the, how I've seen a few how to play videos, but I just can't wrap my head around how this particular abstract works. Everything, every single picture I see of this just looks like magic. This looks like something that wizards play in a fantasy world. And I'm not sure.
That's also true.
Is that the actual book in which this is based off?
There is history to this game.
I don't know if there are wizards in the original book.
Well, do you know anything about the original book?
Nope, not at all. I know the author, basically Patrick Rothfuss, the designer of the game, as well as the artist, the author of the book. The series itself does take place in a fantasy realm. I don't know if it's a more historical fantasy, more wizard fantasy, more. I don't really know the exact situation going on in the book.
Well, it really does look fantastical. Oh my God, Jesse, do we have a copy actually? Like, did you at least buy a cheap one in the meantime so that we can play and have it in our house? Like, is that going to happen or?
I don't own a copy yet, but it is on my radar. It is simple enough to recreate and on my radar of something that I would like to make by hand. Like I've been talking about, I think this would be a lovely game to create.
Man, it's just like I've seen the intricate patterns that are on Etsy. They have combinations of different woods in different places.
I'm going to take some simple birch wood and plywood and just scrape my mark across.
There's even a wormwood edition of this.
Yeah, that's not going to be what
there's
I create.
There's a wormwood edition of Tack?
Yes, I'm looking at it right now. And it is absolutely
you waving, just cost Alex.
I am waving the 48-hour warning.
And Alex, speaking of waving, what are you bringing into the table today?
No, he's busy literally purchasing.
I'm
this
literally
version
busy
of Tack.
Looking for Tack. I don't see it. I don't see it. I need to go.
I think it might have been a limited release, my friend.
Oh my gosh. Okay, we're gonna have words after this. That's it. It's fine. I'm done house hunting. I'm getting Tack instead. And with that, we are bringing in 51st State Master Set. This is going to be a game that we got to the table over the weekend. This is going to be a game that actually, that's not abstract. Although technically it is abstracted. It's very abstracted when you think about it. But it's a game that I actually have my own little history with. You see, I played the original 51st State way back in the day. And I really enjoyed the game and got both expansions to it. And then over time, I don't know exactly what happened, but over time, I eventually moved on for 51st State. And then they came out with Imperial Settlers, which is going to be a re-implementation of that original game. And I got that and didn't really stay in my collection. I didn't appreciate it as much as I liked the original 51st State. And so when I saw the 51st State Master Set, that has been on my list to get for quite some time. And I got it and finally got it to the table. And this is going to be a game which you're taking place in a post-apocalyptic landscape. And it's going to be a card-driven game where you're each playing as different factions, each with slight adjustments to how they manage or develop their resources. At which point, you're basically just taking cards and building them out in a building row. That's what you're doing. You're gathering cards, building them, using them for either deals where you'll get temporary benefits of them, straight up putting them out in the game as buildings, which will give you both in-game benefits as well as end-game points. Or alternatively, just raising them completely from your hand, which is the fastest and quickest way to get something, but only as a one-time benefit. Along the way, there are going to be a few other aspects such as raising your opponent's locations, managing your resources, activating cards to trade different resources in for victory points. It's a little post-apocalyptic management game with enough interaction to be interesting, but not so much to be deadly. And it's one that was interesting to play. And basically, from there, before we even get to 51st State itself, I still have Imperial Settlers Empires of the North, because so far, this system, this game system, has effectively had four different games built around it, of which I have now played three of them. And that's going to be 51st State.
Wow. Jesse, what do you think? This is a...
Jesse is banned from answering this question.
Oh.
I was kind of taught this game by Alex, and I certainly attempted to play it with him.
Attempted? What do you mean attempted?
Well, he got most of the rules wrong, but we won't get into that at the moment.
Alex got rules wrong?
A vast majority of them.
Whoa! When was the last time you played this?
To be fair, I got one tiny little rule wrong in our first session of the game that we reset because it just was the first 2 minutes. And then after that, I only missed one small, small rule that had a very large, large impact.
These are two very different perspectives. Okay, Jesse, from what you played, does this game involve escalating powers and abilities?
Possibly. Not to the same degree that Alex is always looking for, This game involves much more sequencing, resource management, and tableau building, as opposed to direct escalation of powers and abilities. And there is mechanics in it that allow you to directly reduce or harm other players' tableaus.
What is the variability of this game?
Variability. Quite a lot of cards, quite a lot of ways to build out your personal player board. There's also slightly asymmetric players and a lot of expansions for this. So I would say if you enjoy this game, you have enough depth that you'll probably never get bored.
Okay. And I'm assuming this, but based on the videos I've seen, that this is also drafting, like you're drafting cards from a central deck at the beginning.
It's not drafting, but you are pooling and purchasing cards from a central market at the very start of the game, and then you're utilizing those cards from your hand to build out your tableau. Drafting would be maybe a generous way to approach that term.
Okay. Alex, do you have any other games in your library right now that do something similar to 51st States?
You like that kind of question a lot, and I never know the answer offhand.
Well, because you have such a large collection, and I don't ever see you having overlap enough.
Probably yes. Is that what you're looking for?
I mean, I didn't say it was a bad question. I'm just saying I never know that answer offhand.
You don't own Imperial Settlers anymore, and you don't. And there's two versions of this. There's Imperial Settlers, and then
51st State Imperial Settlers, then 51st State Master Set, then Empires Imperial Settlers, Empires of the North.
Empires of the North. Have you played Empires of the North?
No.
Okay.
I know how to mess with him. I know how to mess with him. Okay. I have not played Imperial Settlers Empires of the North, but I'm 99% sure at this point that I'm getting rid of that one without even bothering to play it.
Hmm. I think the time has made you wiser and that you know your interests a lot more. And I feel that 51st State, based on everything that I've heard of this game so far, is one that you will be keeping in your collection. And it's probably the best implementation of this particular system out of all the ones that you've played, or I'm completely wrong and you just hate the system and you just don't need it in your library anymore.
Well, I'm glad you so clearly decided the answer. Well, you didn't say anything.
I did. I said you're keeping it.
The second answer, is going to be correct.
Really?
I'm getting rid of this game. So to be clear here, there's a reason that my little hint there that was meant to throw you off. Practically speaking, if I play a game and I like it, I will, of course, try the better system. I will never sit there and say, no, this one's the best. I will not try the other one. I will just assume that this is the best.
I know. I do the same thing.
It's almost the other way around, is that this is literally my third time through the system, and I do enjoy it. I don't think it's bad. I'm also just not captivated by it.
Mm.
It's fun. It's a cute little puzzle of choosing which cards combo together, which ones will generate the right combination of resources, which drafting, and it's not really not real drafting, which when you're going through the card sequencing where we pull cards one at a time, how am I going to either mess with you a little bit or build up a better engine? How am I going to turn those into enough victory points so we hit 25? Am I going to have the best card roll possible of getting everything done? But if I want a game that does that kind of thing, if I want a game that makes me challenged to figure out all these combinations, I mean, there are a bunch I could think of, but offhand, I'd pick Bruges any day of the week. Bruges is going to give you the same core aspects of picking cards, comboing cards, turning a thing into resources, managing different things, but in a system I drastically prefer. 51st State is very similar to what I remember, and it's very, very similar to playing Imperial Settlers. It's a good system. Lots of cards. Lots of things you can do. It's satisfying, yet not infinitely rewarding.
Now, that is being said by someone that doesn't like a post-apocalyptic world, or just doesn't care for it. Doesn't care for a storyline, doesn't care for art or aesthetic or anything that makes games come to life off the table. He is strictly speaking about the mechanics, the system, and the resource generation or engine.
Yeah, which is
the
conversation that I'm interested in.
Yes. But for those of you that do like a post-apocalyptic theme, the 51st States is describing this fallen America where you have remnants of different cities and civilizations and cultures and people all rising up and doing their very best to live and build a settlement from your core base, which is a big skyscraper or a hotel, outside and metering different distances to different various locations, from ammo bunkers to giant drills that are digging up resources from the earth. This is utilizing and harvesting all the things that a post-apocalyptic game should. I don't disagree with Alex. Granted, he did teach the majority of the game wrong, and that small thing he got incorrect did have a major impact.
What was the small thing? I'm curious.
So there's a mechanic where you're technically only able to do a action once that allows you to trade a pistol for a red distance token that you can use to destroy other players' tableaus.
Yes.
We didn't really realize that that was a one-time use activation and got into a sequence where I believe we probably spent 15 minutes just cycling pistols and destroying other players' tableaus.
Yep.
It felt, let's say, broken. Because
it was.
Well,
it was.
It was.
Well, so to be clear, to be very specific about this game, the reason it didn't impact my decision is because while that aspect of the game was definitely broken, the game felt to me very, very similar to the 51st State I already knew, very similar, more similar to the Imperial Settlers I had since given a try. And the overall engine building that's going on there, the overall card rows, the three different tiers of a production card row, an action card row, and a feature card row, all those things. I mean, if you've played Imperial Settlers, you have played 51st State Master Set. They are basically the same game with different themes and slightly different cards and sequencing, but the overall engine is the same.
And
so despite that rule that we got wrong, that does definitely break the game, it just, the overall game wasn't giving me a different experience from a game that I'd already gotten rid of.
And I totally respect that, but I haven't played any of the others. I don't have a weird history to ascribe everything to, and from my stance, I think the thematics, the aesthetics, and honestly, the mechanics of this game are interesting enough for me to dive back in. I currently own a copy of 51st States, and I'm excited to play it correctly and accurately. Maybe I'll come to the same conclusion as you, but I'm not entirely convinced. I saw enough promise there to be very intrigued in what else it can offer.
So, Alex, I'm very curious. Why did you decide to come back to this after you had already, after you knew that two of the systems were not for you? What specifically within Master Set, you know,
that's an excellent question. And the answer is going to be that the original 51st State, I have very fond memories of. I played it. I went out and hunted down both expansions. Both expansions, by the way, are included in the Master Set. So you're kind of getting all three at once, plus additional content if you want it. But I had fond memories of really liking it, of really being intrigued. And it was in my very first year of gaming. So the fact that I remember more about why I liked the game than I do about why I got rid of the game. But eventually I did get rid of the game. And so when Imperial Settlers came out, I gave it a shot for that exact reason. And yet Imperial Settlers didn't deliver to me. I got 51st State Master Set. I picked that one up because I was hoping it was giving me more of the 51st State experience, but more streamlined. But going by memory and feel alone and not any, you know, facts or anything else, but just purely my instinctive memory of what the game's played like, 51st State to me played more like Imperial Settlers than it did play like the original 51st State. Mm-hmm. And Imperial Settlers never captured my attention. The original 51st State captured my attention, had it for a few years, moved on from it. Imperial Settlers, I gave it a few plays and moved on right away. And so that's going to be the answer there.
So here's my follow-up, because I have played and owned at a certain time Empires of the North. Does this game by the end of it get very unruly? Is there a lot of things that you have to manage? You know, tons of cards that are activating simultaneously, creating crazy combos and turns becoming longer and longer, the deeper you are into the game?
Yeah, I would say so. It's similar to, again, I haven't played Empires of the North, but I have played Imperial Settlers, and all of those, I think, have that aspect of just overall management of stuff.
Yeah, so Empires of the North, I thought was a really fascinating game. It is actually, it is a good system, but because the decks are all asymmetric, there's not a lot of drafting here or a central deck that everyone's sharing and making decisions out of. Every faction does have a potential, I assume based on my plays, has a potential perfect way of implementing it. So it's almost like you're min-maxing your way until perfection for a particular faction. The only deviance that comes in the game that I actually really enjoyed was the incorporation of a not a you pick, you choose, but a centralized area for actions. Basically, you have a small disc that you can move around, and depending on where you land your disc, you're either able or not able to take other types of actions. That was really cool. And there's also an area that's almost like islands that you have to compete for. Empires of the North felt like a race. The race to see who can figure out their machine before the other person. And whoever figures that out earlier will take the game no matter what. And I thought that convention was really cool. It was just the unruliness, like the bigger than the box experience. There was a point in my game, and I'm not sure if I played something incorrectly based on my rereading of the rules, that was not the case. But there was a point in my game where my faction was very aggro, and it would try to take away resources and materials from my opponent. And at this stage of the game, we basically had our entire deck played to a certain degree. We were able to, you know, build up to that point. And I remember telling my opponent, hey, you know what? All of your resources, just take away the ones that will potentially help you the most on your next turn. Because there's just too much to handle and too much to keep track of that I'm not going to waste your time with this. So just take away what you think is probably going to be the most helpful and what would be logical. And that was the Achilles heel in that game for me. It was really cool what it was doing, but it was just too much. So ultimately, if the same is for 51st States and Imperial Settlers, I don't think this is a system that I would either enjoy. But it did seem really interesting from the videos I saw.
This is interesting. Some of the things you're saying about Empires of the North do kind of tempt me to give it another shot. For right now, I don't know. I just think I have enough games that I'm trying to get to the table as it is. And overall, there are still too many similarities to a system that, while I enjoy and while I see why others enjoy it as well, is just one that's not engaging enough for me personally.
Sure, sure. I do want to give Empires of the North a try. But with all that said, ooh, my lord, I think it's time that we innovate a little bit on the show. So as Jesse alluded... No, Jesse.
Is a tricky term.
Oh my god.
Instead, however, we will do our best to have a conversation with you, the audience.
So, as Jesse alluded to at the beginning of this, every episode we've asked you to give your feedback, to go onto the Facebook page, to go onto the website, and let us know your thoughts, to ask us questions, to engage. And you've done that consistently for all of the episodes, but last week was particularly special. We got the most amount of questions that we've ever gotten before. And I wanted to take a moment to celebrate that and to dedicate this entire episode to you, the listeners, and to those people that have decided and that consistently engage in our platform every single week, because we love it. And the hope of this is that we get more of you listeners out there to come in and give your ideas, to ask your questions. We absolutely love it when you interact with us. And if you don't know where you can do that by going to theweeklyquack.com, leaving a comment on the episode. You can do that by going to the podcast, Facebook.
Jen just said you can swing over to theweeklyquack.com.
Jesse, stop.
Or
you can go to the Quacko Podcast Facebook group. And
the
also post your questions there. And oh my God, I am going to kill Jesse. You're lucky that we're not living together yet, because I would have gone and stabbed you at this point. Honestly,
the community.
I've removed all
the spoons from our house. The only thing he has
Lord.
To stab me with are steak knives.
Oh, great! Thank you. You've made my life that much easier. So, with all that said, drum roll, please. Let me introduce.
Waddling straight from the sunny side of the pond, it's the one and only Quackalo Forum! A place where we answer your most burning questions like, did Alex struggle writing his name as a child? What does Jesse hide under that beanie? And how many resources can Jan fit in his beard? Now back to your hosts, Quackalope and Board Game Co.
Wow, everybody give it up for Lorenzo El Espectacular, the official podcast announcer for the Quackalope podcast. I'm very excited about what we're going to be doing today. We're actually planning on going through every single question on the website.
Except that one, you know who you are.
And we're going to go from the very first question that was made on last week's episode, the Cosmic Quack episode. Carl R. asked, if you could sit down and play a game with its designer, who would it be and what game? Bonus question, who else might be sitting at that table?
Easy question. My answer, clearly, chess. I'm not sure who designed it, but that'd be an interesting conversation.
You're horrible, Jesse. Chess is a good game. You leave it alone.
For me, the answer is going to be, and this is an interesting one, but I was trying to think this through because there are a lot of games I like. And the designer space out there in general, while there are a lot of names that have me paying attention, a name by itself is not enough for me. I want something mm-hmm. that in some way I feel more of a connection to, whether it's because I've met the person, whether it's because I've seen enough interviews and personas that I am intrigued as to what it would be like to sit down and play a game with. Ultimately, for me, the answer is going to be ISS Vanguard. With Pavel and Christoph,
Interesting
designers.
Interesting.
Wait, no. Answer. And the people who I'm the person I'm adding to the table is Jesse Anderson. And the reason I'm picking this,
I'm there,
is because I love the idea of watching them who know their creation
get
being
destroyed.
Forced to constantly choose between giving Jesse the agency to make the decisions he does versus being along for the ride or just trying to stop it to guide it. I feel that would be such an amazing experience, both because also I have talked to them as well. So there is that extra personality of I have interacted with them. I do know who they are. And then throwing Jesse and all of us together at ISS Vanguard, the four of us going through that experience, I have to imagine it would be both fun to spend time with them at the creation and also hilariously entertaining at the same time.
It's a perfect answer.
So for me, this might be, this is a tricky one. I have to go for my Euros. And Alex, I unfortunately don't have enough context here to understand who these people are. But I do know that I find them to be incredible designers. And I would love nothing more than to play some of their designs with them at the table. I think my number one choice would be Alexander Pfister. I've loved to sit down at a table, play hopefully Great Western Trail with him. As a bonus of who else I would like to have there, I think I would say Martin Wallace is another person that I'd love to have in that game table. And just for the spritz of somebody that I know for a fact is just like a genuinely awesome person, I think I'd go for Jonathan Ying, which doesn't get enough shout outs in this hobby, you know, Bargain Quest, it's Imperial Assault, etc. I think that would be a really interesting and fascinating conglomeration of people.
I met Jonathan Ying before. It was the very first PAX Unplugged that I ever went to. It was when Quackalope was just beginning to pretend that we would become something. And I actually have I should release it on the Patreon. I have an interview of baby Quackalope before Quackalope was a thing, interviewing Jonathan Ying.
Oh, and he gave you fun. All the time, right? Like he was very patient with you.
He gave me like 20 minutes.
Yeah. Doesn't surprise me. He seems like a genuinely awesome dude.
Yeah. I just talk a lot.
And you know what? Let's go. Since this is a hypothetical, let's go in and add Alexander Pfister, Martin Wallace, and Rosenberg in there. And we got the trifecta.
Sounds good, Jan. And with that, we have another question from What game has your favorite combat system? For me, it's Imperial Assault. For me, that's going to be Beyblade.
Beyblade?
Shut up. Oh my god, Jesse, that we're not trolling our fans. We're trying to genuinely answer
their
questions. It's
easily the best. Are you telling me spinning discs of chaos is not the best combat system you've ever came across?
No, I don't think that's the best system. That's
Alex, you have to respect this just a little bit.
Nope.
Dude,
absolutely
Marbles,
not. That's
Marbles
two
is
troll
even
answers
better.
In a row.
Yeah.
You're doing poorly.
Jesse, come on, man. Come on. Alex, I'll give you a legitimate answer here. And it's actually coming off probably because it's the last thing that we talked about and I can't remember any other fighting strategies right now. It's going to be Sky Tear.
Ooh, I need to play Sky Tear already.
Oh, bro, you're going to absolutely love this game.
No.
We basically read a poem for it.
It's going to be not quite what you expected, and let's be honest, you'll probably get rid of it fairly quickly after you play it for the first time.
I need to play that game.
Good strategy, Jesse. Good strategy. Yeah, Sky Tear is fascinating. So it's one of the only skirmish games that I've been able to sit down with that is not dice dependent. Everything is on your own agency. You have the opportunity to construct your deck, so you can determine how aggro you are, you can determine how flexible you are, and every decision and every card that you're pulling from that deck also creates situations. You know, the cards in this game are like Magic the Gathering. They're quintessential for your strategy. So anything that you're using for an attack will then mean is something that you cannot use for a spell. And that balance of always determining, like, when should I push? When should I not push? Do I have the cards that I need right now? Is it coming? Like, where, through probability, where is that card? That is such a cool conceit. And also just the way that the combat itself works is so straightforward and digestible. I absolutely love it. And another shout out again to an indie publisher here that I loved their game. I don't remember, I haven't played it in a bit, so I don't remember enough, but I remember really, really, really loving this. Giga Robo by Cardboard Dynamo was absolutely awesome. So those are my two mentions for my favorite fighting mechanics.
Do you all want a real answer?
Yes, please.
I would appreciate one. Yes, sir.
Okay. It's still Beyblade, but I'll give a board game answer. Do you want a cooperative game or a PvP game?
PvP.
Whichever you feel is the best combat mechanic.
For a PvP game, right now, the one that is genuinely the most intriguing to me, Alex, say it with me, Bloodstone.
Blood Rage? Bloodstone?
Absolutely.
Wow.
Bloodstone is your favorite combat mechanic?
Wow.
It's a PvP skirmish game. It's a combat arena. I've enjoyed that play experience quite a bit. I don't know what combat mechanic is then, so let me give
arena.
My second answer.
Arena is this combat
let me
game.
Let me give my second answer then. For cooperative, it's going to be Oathsworn.
Oathsworn does have an interesting
okay,
power.
Sure.
Mechanic.
Oathsworn is cool.
That's solid. So
you approve of one of my
there.
Things. Fine. Well, whatever. Yeah,
definitely. So the gap there is going to be, I love Bloodstone. Bloodstone was a ton of fun. I'm looking forward to playing it more. But the combat mechanic is basically rolling dice and utilizing some cards. There's nothing amazingly innovative in the combat mechanic alone.
But it's a fun combat game.
It's if he had asked what your favorite combat game is, that would be a completely legitimate
yeah,
answer.
Yeah,
correct. Oh, I see the difference there.
Yeah, and for me, it's interesting because for me...
So it's still Beyblade.
Still Beyblade. Oh my God. So for me, the answer is going to be actually one of my lower ranked area control combat games, which is going to be Kemet. Even though I know Kemet, I love
really?
Kemet, it's still my top 20. I love the combat resolution in Kemet. I love those cards that you pick one, play one, and then first of all, each card is going to give you three different stats. It's going to give you strength, which is how you win, attack, which is how you deal damage, and defense, which is how you mitigate damage. And you have to draw those cards and play them based on what you think your opponent's going to do, and it's a little bit of a mind game of, well, is your opponent going to lock in the win, or perhaps they anticipate that you're going to lock in the win, so you're going to go for a high defense card once you're losing anyways, so they know that, so they'll actually go with a low attack card with a high high aggression or whatever it is and try to take out your troops along the way and you try to figure out the min max and what you could afford to risk and ultimately those all matter. And then when that's done, you still have to play a card at the end of it. You still have to sit there and still play a card on top of those other cards in order to figure out whether you want to add strength, add this, add that to the game.
Yeah, Alex, Kemet is really enjoyable. The last time I played Kemet, I believe was, I think I played it last year. And it continues to be a great game.
So I'm going to take the next question from Eric W., who brings in a challenge, should you choose to accept it.
Oh, my God.
You must write reviews of board games. Yeah. They must be concise, witty, and a surprising take on a well-known game.
Oh,
I got
God.
It.
These should be similar to the 10-second reviews Alex just did on his channel, but not so on the spot. Give yourself some time to think. The host with the best review gets 12 victory points, which should be awarded in the comment section of the following week's episode. So
this isn't fair.
This
Jesse's going to win.
No, if I'm hearing this correctly, this is not... in a question for on the spot, just the opposite. Au contraire, we have to take our time and think of exactly the answers we want by bringing in 10-second reviews to next week's episode.
There's
okay,
nothing,
next week. Minute.
There's nothing quite like the smell of death dice and lion balls. In this game, build your gear grid, venture through the hunt phase, encountering mysterious and dark machinations of the underworld. And then fight. Fight to your heart's content. Until either your face is ripped off, or your enemy's has been. This is Kingdom Death Monster. A game of brutal conquest. And sheer sheer despair.
I give you a 3. That was horrible. Oh,
I can do one better.
The only thing more depressing, dark, and destructive than Kingdom Death Monster is trying to get your hands on a copy.
Oh, burn. Yeah, Jesse.
Joke's on you. All you need for a copy is money.
Oh, God, these monotone things, I don't like them. Okay.
So, moving on. So, Eric W., challenge accepted. We've taken notes. We will figure this out, or at least we'll forget until 2 seconds before next week's episode. Mark P., question. What percentage of the games currently in your collections are at least 3 years old? How many are at least 5 years old?
Oh.
Do you practice what you preach, or has your role as content creator skewed your collections towards newer games?
Oh my
games?
God, this is a great one.
How different would your collections be if you weren't content creators?
Ooh, okay. This is a fascinating question. Okay, so games that have survived my library for over 3 years is a huge achievement, okay? And I don't believe that I have too many of those, but there are some in there. In terms of how content creation
I'm
has...
I'm not even convinced I'll survive your collection for 5 years.
Oh, you won't, but that's not the conversation right now. so the way that I've approached content creation from this standpoint is that Jesse's really the one that's mainly keeping these games. I still have very much had to focus and find titles by my own accord.
Aggressively gifting as much as I can to the people who come join us on the show. Keeping is a stretch at best. I'd like to only own 3 games, 2 of which are Beyblade.
And Tac.
Season 1 and Season 2.
There's seasons to Beyblade? I feel you're making this up already.
There's a TV show to Beyblade. Are you kidding me?
So for me, I don't think becoming a content creator has actually changed the way that I incorporate games into my library. It has changed the way that I consume games now. And it's actually been fairly helpful for my spending habits because I don't have this insatiable need of trying to play every new mechanic under the sun. With that said, I would venture to say that my collection is currently about 30% games that have stayed in my collection for 3+ years. The other 40% are games that have been here for around 1.5 to 2 years, and then the rest of that is just going to be titles that are just cycling in constantly.
Yeah, I don't follow these rules at all, but mostly because I'm terrible at getting rid of games. I get a ton of new things, and I play a ton of new things, and I honestly don't have a ton of time to not do that until hopefully this next year. This next year, Jan and I are going to be making a point of and focusing on covering some of the historical titles. I would love to do a series where we go through the top 100 on BGG and do some sort of media coverage on every single one of them. So I don't necessarily live up to the standard that I set, but I would like to. I'd aspire to be a bit more responsible and tactical when it comes to the type of games that I keep in my permanent board game collection.
So for myself, it's going to be, and I don't have any off-the-cuff exact percentages, but I would wager that a good percentage of my collection is larger than 3 years old and larger than 5 years old. I'd argue most of them, really. I mean, if I had to make a guess off the cuff, I'd say 80% is over 3 years old and maybe 60% is over 5 years old. To a certain extent, I like both the new and I like the old, and that hasn't really changed with content creation. There has been a change, which I'll get to, but overall, I have always taken the stance of I always want to try new games. I always want to see what's out there. Most of them will not make the cut long term. Some will stick around for a year. Some will stick around for 5 years. Some won't make it past the first play. But I'm always interested in what else there is out there in order to see what I can add. My favorite games, inherently, I put out a video on this once. It's one of my favorite videos of all time. But my favorite games inherently are games that at one point I had never played. To discover and add these to my collection, I had to try something new, which is why I love both the Cult of the New as well as revisiting them because I now love them. As far as how my collection is different if I was or wasn't a content creator, it's likely going to mostly come down to when I try those new games. Before being a content creator, I used to wait a year or so to see if the market validated a game. People talk about all the new games all the time, but a year later, they often aren't quite as much. That game that everyone's trying and people are taking photos of on Facebook and you're sharing and you feel a little left out, I used to not get those.
Blood Rage, Terraforming Mars, Spirit Island. These are all some of my favorite games, and they're all games that I waited a year or so plus to see if people still talked and cared about them after they were hot and new. Versus now, being a content creator, now I have to be at the forefront because that is what people want to know. People want to see you talk about the new games. They want to know about them when it's relevant and not 2 years later. So now suddenly I am experiencing a wider variety of new things because I'm engaged in content creation. The end result of my collection? It's going to be exactly the same. But when and how I experience new games, that has been a shift for me.
So, as you were saying that, Alex, I started taking account to the actual games that have survived my library for 3+ years, and I think I my percentage was way off. Apparently, the games that have been in my library for 3+ years so far have been Santorini, Hentai's, Food Chain Magnate, Monsterlands, Millennium Blades, and a game by the name of Ferox, which I will be very surprised. And if you do know about this game, let me know in the comments. That is 6 games out of my library that I believe has over 70 games in it. Most of them are going to be within the last two, like I said, 1.5 years. So apparently, the percentage for me is going to be, what, like a 10%? 10% games 3+ years. And 60% of the rest.
You're doing your very best. I just have to end this on one of the dreams that I really genuinely hope to do one day, which is I would love to not only cover the top 100 games on BGG, I've also always really wanted to have a shelf that's just categorized and organized with all of them. So we have like a living document of shifting ranks. I don't know. For some reason, I feel like that'd be very cool. But again, this is clearly not sticking to what we've told the audience to do. That being said, I do have a question from Quacks. Spirits, wine, beer, or cider? Bourbon, my friend. Bourbon across the board.
Come on. You must like one of those at least. I'm a cider guy through and through.
Spirits would be.
Oh, that's
spirits
true.
Would qualify. As bourbon.
That's true. I'm a cider man or a sour beer man. I just like that fruity flavor, I guess.
But the real question from Quacks is going to be this. If a crowdfunded game has a tabletop simulator or similar module, and that is released to content creators, it should also be made available to the public backers. Mm-hmm. Why or why not?
So I think that is a complicated question. And first of all, the should is going to ultimately come down to the publisher themselves, what they feel is best for the game. But more often than not, the reason to release the mod to the public is ultimately going to come down to the fact that you are giving more people an opportunity to play, more people an opportunity to build confidence in their product, in your game, which on the one hand is a service to the people because they can see if it's for them. And also it could well be a service to yourself if you get more of a buzz, more people trying it, more people playing it. The flip side, and the reason not to, is going to come down to two reasons. The first is there's a risk that the game just might not be good. There is always that risk. It's always a concern. Or
now,
I don't think games aren't good. I think games aren't necessarily good for you. And so it's more of a...
I hear you. But I also have to jump in and just say there's not only a risk the game might not be good, but there's a risk the game might not be good on TTS.
Hey, sir, you are taking away my second and third reason.
I know, but you don't get to monopolize all of this. And you said 2 points to begin with, so why add
Fine,
in a third?
You could have reason
listen,
two. I'll go
listen,
for reason three.
Here's the standard argument against and for. Four, you want as many people to experience your game as possible. If you're excited and proud and ready to show it off, that is a great way to do so, especially in today's day and age. But the point that Alex was making before, you know, he talked for too long and I interrupted him, is going to be the fact that the games that we get on TTS are unrefined abominations of the games that you're going to get in person. They're not only worse on TTS, but they are scripted modules or experiences that really genuinely need the publisher there to hold your hand and walk you through and help you understand what they're trying to display. A public getting access to that would likely result in a pretty poor overall experience.
But here's the thing. I feel that the game itself is always going to be the game. And with the increasing cost of our hobby and just the amount of games that are out there, it is important that we have some type of space where we can taste or get a sampling of something, even if it's not the best sampling possible. There's a lot of gamers, for example, people in Latin America that have a lot of difficulty just trying out titles, and the luxury of having a board game store or having a friend that might have the title is practically impossible. So the only way that they get to experience a game at all is through these digital implementations, right? So,
but the problem with that argument is that is one thing to make the argument that a publisher should let you try the thing, see if it's good. It's one thing, and I don't even necessarily agree with that either. But it's an entirely other thing to say they should give you a suboptimal experience because at least you walk away with a little bit more information, even if it's not a full picture of that thing.
And isn't that kind of what the previews are there for in some ways? I mean, we do our very best to display, you know, breakdowns and rules mechanics and overviews and gameplay and as much content and information as we can so that we can responsibly let people know whether or not a game is going to be right for them. I understand both sides of this argument, and it really, for me, is going to come down, and I know this is going to be an unsatisfactory answer, but it's going to come down to the game, the publisher, the point at which the Kickstarter is launching, how developed the finished product is, and how ready it is for a mass market experience. Publishers already get such a degree of vitriol and lashback and frustration when things aren't perfectly refined in the finished product, let alone releasing something way too early before it's been playtested and retested and refined for a larger audience base. They can promise something and promise an experience, and reviewers can understand what that is. I'm not sure the wider board game community, off of one play experience in a suboptimal operating system, would always walk away with the best or correct interpretation of that medium.
Yeah, my fear with that type of approach is that then we are disincentivizing completely the idea of sharing and keeping these as public as possible. I'm all for having these opportunities so people can experience more things at more time. What I would say, one of the beauties of our hobby that I think has been valid, completely proven this year, is that it doesn't matter how much you play a game digitally. If the game is something you enjoy, you're always going to want the physical copy, because it's just it'll never really translate. And with that, our next question is actually going to come straight from the Facebook. And it's from Lara Escar. This is a simple one. Lara Escarasquillo asks, Tabletopia versus Tabletop Simulator, do you have any preference?
Yeah, I mean, Tabletop Simulator every day of the week. Next question. Tabletopia is cumbersome and oftentimes fairly frustrating to use. I understand it gives the publisher more control over what exactly they're releasing to the public, and, you know, puts it behind a little bit of a paywall. I understand the benefits of that operating system, but the reality is the physics engine in Tabletop Simulator and the ability for people to script, adjust and adapt and improve the experience overall is much more positive.
Yeah, I would have to say that the customization within Tabletop Simulator will always best anything that's in Tabletopia. With that said, Tabletopia is a lot more accessible. It is easier for a lot of different computers and different environments. So it's just very easy to get a game in there without having to download the additional software for Tabletop Simulator. So one thing that we usually forget is that Tabletop Simulator is actually a paid program. So not everybody has access to that, or even a computer that can run it due to the physics engine within it. So I think Tabletopia is a necessary evil. I agree with you 100%, Jesse, but I do think it's worth that. Usually, if a game is supposed to be enjoyed digitally, it should probably be on both platforms ultimately.
So for myself, I actually walked into the game originally liking Tabletopia much more than Tabletop Simulator. I thought it was much more streamlined. I thought it was much more crisp and clear. It felt so amazing to me. And Tabletop Simulator to me felt like a poor secondary. I don't know exactly what it is. Maybe it's the graphics. It just feels slightly tuned up or touched up or something. I don't know exactly. But over time, I've really grown to drastically prefer Tabletop Simulator. Something about it, even though the graphics, I think, are slightly better in Tabletopia, I think Tabletop Simulator delivers a slightly better user experience, and that ultimately is going to win at points that you just can't get otherwise. There are every time I jump into Tabletopia nowadays, I find myself looking for those little small features, those accessibilities, those shortcuts, those things, the ability to draw cards from a deck and just hit a number and tap and they go straight to your hand, the ability to drag a circle over a bunch of dice or something like that, as opposed to the way it's handled on Tabletopia. I just find the overall experience in Tabletop Simulator to be slightly more refined, while Tabletopia is slightly better looking. And I'm fine with both, but the more refined gameplay is going to win out.
Yeah, I think across the board, we support Tabletop Simulator the most. But like I said, both are necessary here. So the next question is going to come from Cole Miller. And Cole Miller asks, so one of my favorite parts of the hobby is finding awesome deals on board games with my girlfriend. My question is, back when y'all were peasants like us and didn't get board games from publishers for free, what is the best deal you've gotten and how do you go about finding your cheap board games?
I'm glad he used my term peasants. I'm not sure I've used it before, but I'll stand by it. Yes. How do I go about getting cheap board games?
You don't even spend a second, Jesse.
What?
You don't spend a second searching. If you want a game, you just buy it from wherever it's the most accessible.
Me? No.
Well, go ahead. Prove me wrong. Where do you search for your cheap board games, Jesse? What is your process-y?
I become friends with people, so I don't need to own anything.
So I'm actually really glad that somebody asked me this, because this is my life. This is how I've survived in this hobby. Since the very beginning, one of the reasons why I decided to get into board gaming, into the aggressive stance I took, was because of the resale potential that every single game that comes into my library has. But that also means that I have access to absolutely anything I want from those same channels. So I don't remember necessarily what the best deal I've ever gotten on a game was. I think I got Zia, the entire collection of Zia, for like $80, which is kind of crazy for that particular game system. I got it for all the expansions, the game itself. It was fantastic. I don't know if that's the best deal I've gotten, but I circle a lot of different spaces. If you want a game for cheap, you have to put in the work and you have to ask the question. The places where I ask these questions are going to be Facebook, they're going to be Reddit, and it's also going to be through the BGG Marketplace. So the BGG Marketplace, if you ever go to the trade section, you're able to search the entire database for people that have your game. So if I'm looking for something in specific and I'm very keen on not paying for it, I will send a message to over 20 different people that have the game I want, and I will either offer them cash or offer them different options within my own library to try and make that happen. But mainly, I think Facebook is actually one of the best spaces for selling and getting games for cheap that I have ever come across. And it's particularly three main groups that have the bulk of that trade. They have huge communities, and you're very likely to find absolutely anything you're looking for there, almost guaranteed. That's going to be called the Board Game Group Buy, Trade, and Sell, Board Game Traders, Board Game Exchange, the original Buy, Sell, and Trade Board Game Group. And as a little bonus, there's a smaller one that's called Buy, Sell, and Trade Board Games with an exclamation mark at the end. If you subscribe to each one of those groups, I guarantee you, you will get cheap games and you will be able to find any game that you're looking for at hopefully an agreeable price point.
Yeah, for myself, it's going to be, and first of all, I should say, I do agree that all those Facebook groups are great opportunities. But my original starting point as far as where I got my games from were going to be a few places. The first is going to be a store called One Eye Jacques. I really got a lot of games from them. It's a ding and dense store that runs, I think they're still in business. I think they still sell stuff. They sell stuff on eBay, but they basically sell ding and dent games that you're getting brand new and shrink games that have a corner ripped for a significant percentage off the price point. I got a lot of new games that way. The second is going to be Board Game Geek Auctions.
BoardGameGeek auctions is where I got an absolute ton of games. The marketplace is good. The marketplace, you can find deals sometimes. But more often than not, if you walk into an auction, especially the auctions that have a lower starting price point, you will just be able to find a lot of games reasonably priced, not because they aren't worth more, but because they have a starting bid that is smaller and not enough people hunting for those games. And so both of those were going to be a huge part of my early collection hunting and building up my collection.
Wow, I've never gotten into an auction by the fear of just getting priced out or paying too much for a game at some point.
That's a good idea, Jan, because when you're in an auction, you do become emotionally invested to winning, even when you
should. Exactly.
It might surprise you to know that I do actually have an answer to this, but it won't be straight board games. You see, when I first got into this hobby, I fell in love with a little-known game called Kingdom Death, one that I have been avoiding answering for every question in this segment of the show.
It is a big part of your experience.
And I, at one point, owned the most complete resin collection of this game in the entire community. I was probably one of the first people to specifically seek out and collect every single historical model that I could.
Jesse, say it in the world. Say it, like live it.
And since then, a few other members of the community, many of which I have sold models to or gifted models to, have gone on to surpass my collection, and I'm super proud and excited for them and what they have. But when I was searching for models and the best deal on models or the rare and, you know, exquisite ones, I just made myself part of every online and digital space and community that I could. Mm-hmm. I was checking eBay every 15 minutes. I had keyword optimization up so that it would alert me whenever something was triggered. I was chatting with and engaging with a variety of different people, and people were open to trades, to purchasing. There was a lot of behind the scenes sales that happened. So if you're looking for cheap games or looking for a way to grow your board game library, probably the best strategy I could have for you would be the same one that I utilized when I was in the collecting or rare model hunting mode. Be a part of whatever space you want to have a collection in. Talk with people, share ideas, let them know what you're searching for, express interest in a variety of games. I would venture to guess that a lot of people in this community would be happy to share something with you or gift something to you or sell it to you at market or below market pricing if they just know that you'll enjoy it and appreciate it. That happened to me in the Kingdom Death community from time to time, and I'm sure it bleeds over into the board game space as well.
Cool. And with that, we have one more question left, and this is going to be from Raven. If you could have your best solo game or a mediocre game with your group, which do you prefer? As in, do you value the game for the gameplay itself, or do you value the socialization that accompanies the game? This is a tricky one.
Oh.
Because I very much do value the socialization.
The flavor text is just as good on each one.
Well, it can't be. That's the whole point of the question.
The best flavor text ever, or mediocre flavor text with friends?
My answer to this is super easy. 100% I value the people more than anything else. I don't care if the game is bad. If the people around me are, I know how to have fun, to laugh at a bad game, and just make a night out of that, I will always prefer my friends.
Let me answer before Alex as well, because this will be a fun sequence of events. Yeah, of course it's the community above all. I mean, board games are something that facilitate a space that I can exist in, right? I desperately needed them, but not because I needed to play mechanics or systems or deck building games. It was because I was lonely and I needed friends, and board games bridged that gap. It's why I'm so passionate about the community now. It's why I'm so dedicated to building a table where everyone is welcome. And, you know, why would I care how good a game is if I could have an amazing group of people around me?
Yep, exactly.
So for me, cold and dead that I am inside.
Oh my God, Alex.
It's going to be more nuanced. We have to define what mediocre is.
Okay.
We'd have to define what mediocre is. If you're saying, would I rather play the best games in my collection by myself or the worst games in my collection with others, it would be the worst games in my collection.
Oh.
Uh-huh.
But
collection is so refined, none of them would be deemed mediocre.
That's a great point.
Essentially, yes. Those are games that I love. What about games that I love?
All right. How about this? How about the worst games in Jan's collection.
Oh, well, shut
let's
up.
Let's be more specific. Let's pick a game. I mean, so Jen, what's a few games you have? Tell me a few games you have.
I'm going to give you Jesse's favorite, Barrage.
I haven't played that one. I can't speak to it.
Well, you do own it. Barrage. You do own it now.
Yeah, but I haven't played it yet, though. I have to give an example of something I've played. But
well, whatever you do, play it with people.
Let's take a game that I have gotten rid of. A game, I don't think of anything right, offhand.
I've got one.
Go ahead.
Love certain versions of Zombicide, but there are versions of Zombicide that are abjectly mediocre when it comes to your judgment of them.
I would take them with people over the best versions of Zombicide alone. Okay. 100%.
So you do because sometimes care about people.
Good versus great. I will choose the people with good that over the myself with great. But once you start talking about games that I have said that I don't really feel the need to have in my collection, games I've moved on from, then it's a much harder question to answer. I mean, think about an experience you've had, Jesse, that you didn't like playing.
Yeah.
And then think of that compared to playing Spirit
Unicorn
Island.
Unicorn Fever. I hard noped out of Unicorn Fever.
But then you played it again.
I thought it was a game that I very much vehemently did not want to experience again. And then I was sitting around the table with Jan and William one late night drinking some bourbons, having a good time with two friends that I would do the world for. And I pulled Unicorn Fever off the shelf. And while it's still, you know, responsibly, that's a mediocre game.
Oh my God.
My friends made the difference.
So this is a good question. Would you rather play Unicorn Fever with friends or Spirit Island or Terraforming Mars alone?
Yeah, Unicorn Fever with friends.
Of course. Ooh. Come on. This is
solid.
Like, what are board games about? They're about being together. It's about people. Sure, I understand that the solo community is huge in this and that it's also important, but ultimately, most board games are going to focus on that human element, and that's why I got into this hobby in the first place.
Yeah, the only thing I'm not willing to give up for humans is Kingdom Death, and that's because it's large enough I could be buried in it.
Oh, and Peter Rye, I would totally play Rush MD with you. And to everyone who made it all the way to the end, we hope you enjoyed this community-centered episode. Let us know in the comments if we should bring it back and what questions we should answer for the next forum. And remember, curiosity killed the cat, but certainly not the duck. We'll see you guys next time.
This latest failed attempt at bringing you quality entertainment was brought to you by the Quackalope Podcast. We love to hear from you, so don't forget to leave a review and subscribe. If you'd like to connect with us, follow us on any of our social channels or visit our website. But regardless of what you do, remember to do the important thing. Get out and play some games. Until next time.